stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting. Turkey says today's deadly blast were carried out by suicide bombers. Two bomb explosions targeted a peace rally being held by leftist and Kurdish activists in the Turkish capital of Ankara. It killed 86 people and wounded 186. The explosions occurred seconds apart outside Ankara's main train station as hundreds were gathering for the rally, organized by Turkey's Public Sector Workers Union and other civic society groups. The rally aimed to call for increased democracy and an end to the renewed violence between Kurdish rebels and Turkish security forces. There was no immediate claim of responsibility for the deadliest attacks in Turkey in years. Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu said there were strong signs that the attacks, which struck 50 meters apart, were suicide bombings. He declared a three-day official mourning period for the victims, as well as for all of those killed in terror attacks since July. Hours after the attacks, the Turkish government imposed a temporary news blackout covering images that showed the moment of the blast, gruesome or bloody pictures or images that create a feeling of panic. The spokesman warned media organizations they could face a full blackout if they didn't comply. Here in Washington, the White House condemned what it called an horrific attack in the Turkish capital. The U.S.-led coalition targeted Islamic State in Syria with five airstrikes Friday. It also hit the militant group with 20 bombardments in Iraq, according to a statement released on Saturday. In the meantime, Syrian government forces captured a village from rebels in the central province of Hama Saturday as they pushed a ground operation backed by Russian air support. This is VOA News. European Union countries and non-EU nations now have much more authority in combating human trafficking in the Mediterranean Sea off the coast of Libya. The UN Security Council passed a resolution Friday permitting countries to search and seize vehicles suspected of human trafficking. The resolution also authorizes the use of force. This is Matthew Rycroft, the British ambassador to the UN.
Any action will be proportional, in keeping with the limits authorized by this resolution, and used solely against the smugglers and empty boats. Any migrants encountered as part of the operation will be taken to Europe as part of established procedures.
Italy marked a milestone in the migrant crisis Friday by flying the first group of asylum seekers to Sweden. The action is part of the EU's new relocation program that aims to resettle migrants throughout Europe, sharing the burden of the migrant crisis. Under the EU plan, countries will receive compensation for accepting and transporting the refugees. A Palestinian attacker stabbed three policemen just outside the Old City in East Jerusalem Saturday before police forces say they shot him dead. Authorities say one of the police officers was seriously wounded. Two others were moderately hurt. The scene of the stabbing is near where a Palestinian teenager stabbed two Israelis before police shot him dead earlier in the day. A wave of stabbings has rocked Israel in recent days, resulting in attacks on civilians and soldiers. The attack started in East Jerusalem at a holy site revered by Muslims and as the Al-Aqsa Mosque and by Jews as the Temple Mount. A hospital official and residents say at least three people have died. Some 50 have been injured in pre-election violence in Guinea. A hospital worker who insisted on anonymity because he is not authorized to speak to the press said the deaths and injuries have been caused by violence since Thursday. Opposition demonstrators have clashed with supporters of President Alpha Conde, who is running for re-election in polls on Sunday. A mayor says a group of suspected jihadists attacked a village in central Mali, killing a local official in front of his family. Haruna Balem, the mayor of Diogani municipality, says the attackers are suspected members of the radical Messina Liberation Movement, which has been blamed for other attacks this year that have targeted military and civilian authorities in south and central Mali. Diogani lies close to the Burkina Faso border. Bilham says the extremists came into the village of Dunapene Friday afternoon and shot Timote Codillo in front of his wife. She suffered a heart attack and was rushed to a health center. Attacks by extremists are moving south. The group is said to have ties to the Islamic extremists.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
We're going to try to increase exports and others. That the guy is strong, cut back on spending, and all those kinds of things.
Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika plans to jumpstart the country's faltering economy.
The committee has already been set up. They are going to start screening them on Tuesday. Screening means, of course, getting their documents, paper qualifications, experiences, what have you.
The Nigerian Senate plans to begin vetting President Muhammadu Buhari's ministerial nominees.
Dès le matin, ils ont repris, ils ont vengé contre nous.
He says in the morning, looters came and attacked their shops. They're in the streets to defend against the looters.
A riot leave one person dead in the Guinean capital, Conakry, ahead of the presidential election on Sunday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika says his administration is implementing new measures to stabilize the country's currency, the kwacha, in a bid to jumpstart the faltering economy. In part one of our exclusive interview, President Mutharika outlined some of the challenges Malawi faces and the policies his government is putting in place to resolve them.
First of all, I think part of the reason is, of course, of a weak export base, and for that the other currencies are strong. And in a way, I think the kwacha was overappreciated anyway. So it's probably depreciating to Eastern the normal level. But we're going to try through increasing exports and others to make sure that the kwacha is strong, cut back on spending, and all those kinds of things. We're going to look at interest rates, perhaps. So there are a number of challenges which we are facing, but it's going back to what happened before, the whole issue of Cashgate, and the fact that the donors have left. You see, the donors were providing 40% of the current budget. Now that's now zero, and we had to find that money somewhere. Obviously, we have not been able to find all of it.
Talking about cutting back on expenses of the government, you recently implemented measures where certain officials of the government cannot travel to save the country money. How is it going so far, and do you think it's the right step forward to achieving your objective of cutting down spending?
No, it's not true that they cannot travel. Everyone can if they are, you know, if their portfolio or their work demands, they can travel. But are simply limited. For ministers, for example, I've said that they can only make 3 international trips a year, paid for by the Malawi government. Only 3. And domestically, I've said that the ministers cannot accompany me or even other part of government officials if their portfolio is affected. If I'm going, for example, to open a hospital, and there's no need for the Minister of Agriculture to come there, but the Minister of Health can come. That way, it does cut back costs because, you see, if the ministers came, they would come with their drivers and then their assistants and also their bodyguards and themselves. All those people are getting allowances. And by that alone, over 5 years, we're going to save over 70 billion, which is about 20 million U.S. dollars.
You spoke about Cashgate, corruption. What steps are you taking to plug the loopholes so that the public funds are not siphoned out of the country?
Exactly. First of all, certainly people are being tried. Those people who committed this crime are being tried. Now, in terms of the Cashgate thing itself, we are carrying out the public financial management reform to make sure that there are more controls. But on the human level, I think the most important thing is accountability and also control. That the controlling officer should really be controlling. at the department. Make sure that the express are proper, that if somebody says they're going to take a trip and they're giving them money, then they should take that trip, or if they don't, then they should return the money. Those kinds of things, a culture of accountability, which somehow disappeared, and we're trying to restore that.
Let me ask you about service delivery. Some Malawians I spoke with have complained or have expressed concern about lack of electricity and water. And some are saying that if not resolved, because they repose confidence in you, they said if these are not resolved, your chances of re-election bid could be a challenge for you. So what steps are you taking to resolve these?
We said first electricity. We're trying to prove, you know what? You know, we only have 351 megawatts of electricity for our country, so there's a deficit already. Now, that's hydro. And now, with the drying sort of low levels of the water, about 80% cannot be produced of megawatts. That's a lot. That's why there's this shedding. We had a problem with transmission. You see, some of the power lines are extremely old, and they lose half of the electricity. That's why we're working with the Miriam Change Corporation of the United States. In fact, five contracts were signed this week for transmission, American contracts to improve the transmission, and that will help. But you see, transmission alone without generation doesn't do any good. So we have to generate electricity, and we're trying to add initially 300 megawatts, but eventually 1,000 through a coal-fired plant in Malawi near the Mozambique border. So we'll be doing that and also complement that with solar.
Arthur Peter Mutharika is the Malawian president. He spoke with me from New York. A Senate committee in Nigeria has been established to begin vetting President Muhammadu Buhari's list of prospective ministers on Tuesday. Senator Bukar Abba Ibrahim says President Buhari submitted a first batch of 21 nominees on September 30 to be vetted by the Senate. This will allow Buhari to assign them their ministerial portfolios after they are approved by the Senate as enshrined in the Constitution. Ibrahim told me the Senate will be thorough in the vetting process on the list before Buhari presents them with their portfolios.
The committee has already been set up. They are going to start screening them on Tuesday. Screening means, of course, getting their documents, paper qualifications, experiences, what have you. And then the Senate will approve and return to Mr. President. That should definitely be done in batches. After all, he has only brought the first set of 21. There are still going to be 15 more. Every state is going to have a minister. So there will be 36 ministers in all, out of which 21 have been presented now. The remaining 15 will soon be presented, inshallah.
Senator Ibrahim, how thorough do you think this process is going to be?
Well, so far, out of the 21 names he has nominated, I don't know of anybody who has a bad record who is likely to be rejected by the Senate. There are a few controversial figures, but those controversies are mainly political and should not deter Mr. President from nominating them. If they are found to be guilty of one thing or the other later, of course, he could always remove them and replace them with others. But for now, I think so far, so good. Of all the ones I personally know, they all have good records. They've all been tested in several ways at the national level and at their state levels. So I think it's a good start.
How has Nigerian citizens been reacting to this, and particularly citizens from your constituency?
Well, we have not been given a minister yet. Nobody from my state has, for example, been nominated yet. But looking at Muhammad Buhari's record, it's a very straightforward, very honest man with integrity. I believe whatever process he must have followed, he must have followed it thoroughly, and I don't think he will bring anybody of questionable character
Critics of the president and the administration have said that it seems the list that the president had submitted are full of men and the women are very, very few. What do you say to such criticisms?
Well, I think it's premature. There are three women right now, and I know all of them. There are people I've worked with, all the three or four of them now, I think three of them. I worked with all of them. They are okay. Let's see the balance. It might probably bring more women in the 15 names to be submitted later. After all, the affirmative action women talk so much about talks about 30%. And 30% of 36 is 12. So we have three now. We are able to get additional 9 names out of the 15. That will satisfy the affirmative action so much believed in by Nigerian women.
Once this process is done, what in your mind should Nigerians expect from these officials who have been vetted by the Senate?
Well, I expect them to do very well. I expect them to work very well. And Mr. President became a president long before them, 4 months before they became ministers. And Mr. President has been fully briefed by the permanent secretary and heads of parastatals and government units all over. So the president is very far ahead of them, and he knows what is happening in the government better than any minister. So no minister can mislead him or misguide him or deceive him. That is a very important strategic step the president took by coming in first, knowing almost everything about the ministries and parastatals and agencies, and now bringing in ministers who will now begin to learn something about their ministries. Mr. President is already far ahead of them in knowing what is happening. And I think that will help Mr. President in making his administration a smooth one. And I know Mr. President is an integrity man. He has integrity, and he wouldn't like anybody to spoil that integrity by bringing questionable characters. As I said earlier, the characters I know are all good characters. They've been tried as governors, as former ministers and former legislators and so on and so forth before they became ministers.
Bukar Abba Ibrahim is a Nigerian senator. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Ghana Chamber of Commerce presents a Business Outlook Conference theme, Putting Ghana's Opportunities in the Spotlight, today in Washington, D.C. TEP Envoy Lieutenant General Henry Smith, Ghana's Ambassador to the United States, and Dr. Hannah Bisu, Ghana's Deputy Agricultural Minister, will be at the forum. Dr. Bisu joins us live in our studios here in Washington, D.C. to highlight what investors should expect at the Business Summit today. Good afternoon, Dr. Bisu.
Good afternoon, Peter.
So tell me, before we begin, what role do you see the African woman playing in politics on the continent?
Well, I think that the African woman has come, you know, very far. We started when we're not allowed to, you know, be on the front seat. Today you have African woman who is a president. Today we have African women who are ministers of state. Today when you come to Ghana, we have, for the first time, a woman who is in charge of the Electoral Commission of our country. Then you also have the Chief Justice, who is also a woman. And the last parliament, the fifth parliament, the Speaker of Parliament was a woman, and that was the first time, you know. And so I think that we've now moved from the forum, the kitchen, and we've joined our men, you know, in the mainstream of decision-making, because I always say that in any case, the African woman is the only woman who goes and fetches the firewood. We go to the stream to fetch water. We come to cook. We sweep, we clean. We take our children to school. And so who better than us will be able to know where we want a borehole to be situated, why we want pipe on water, you know, why we want electricity, and all these things. And so for me, I think that the African woman was born an administrator, a leader, you know, by nature. And we only take in the formal role, that God gave to us when we were born.
Well said. Let me ask you about Ghana's agricultural sector at the moment vis-a-vis the investment opportunity at today's summit. What would you say is the state of affairs in the agricultural ministry?
I think that Ghana's agriculture is doing very well right now. And we have, you know, two or three main sections. We have the fishery, we have the livestock, then we have crops. In these three sections, you know, there are vast opportunities for investment. When you come to livestock, you know, we usually will talk about the value chain. You know, you talk about maize, you know, there's a huge opportunity of investment in maize, in soya, in poultry, in piggery, you know, in cattle. And you come to crops, we have, we have huge investment opportunities also in pineapple, in mango, in rice, in tomatoes. And we have also huge opportunities in, you know, people even coming up and putting up fertilizer, you know, factories to produce fertilizer in our country for our local use. Because, you know, as we speak, we import a lot of fertilizer into the country. The demand is very high. So when you come, I'm sure, at the forum, investment forum, we will, you know, expand, especially on whatever we have in agriculture sector.
Now, some people have expressed concern that a huge amount of the harvest gets wasted in tomatoes, vegetables and all that. Are there any avenues of investment opportunities where the government can formulate policies to ensure preservation or canning or such to feed the people, since they say majority of this harvest go to waste?
Exactly. When I spoke about the, you know, business opportunities in the crop sector, you know, and spoke about the value chain, you know, it included all of these. That is, there's a huge opportunity for the investor to come in and, you know, invest in, you know, tomato factory where we add value to the tomato that we produce. You add value the pineapple we produce, mm-hmm. You add value to the crops that we produce, even our own poultry that we can add value to it. So government has also made it such a way that investment in agriculture, you have some sort of tax holidays. If you have to bring things into the country, you know, for agriculture, you have tax waivers to make sure that it simplifies, and then it becomes, the cost of production becomes also cheaper for you. So some of these things, they are there. I think when we get to the forum, I'll explain so that investors will know exactly what to do, where to go, and to know that, you know, when you invest in agriculture in Ghana, you're not going to lose your money. Mm. And, you know, that the environment is friendly, you know, it's a stable country politically, and we have a lot of incentives, you know, for the investor who wants to come in and invest in, you know, in the agriculture sector.
What do you say to critics who say that Ghanaians should not go hungry and Ghanaians should not go to neighboring countries to import food, especially when the large majority of the land in Ghana, crops can easily grow? They say the government has not come up with any policy to ensure food sufficiency. What is your answer to that?
Well, I think that I will say they are right or not. They are right that we shouldn't be importing, you know, so much from outside when we can produce. We produce a lot of rice, we produce a lot of tomatoes, we produce, you know, the palm oil itself, which we can get cooking oil from. We produce a lot of things in our country that we should not go hungry. But of course, the post-harvest losses, you know, have always been huge because the value addition is where we lack. And so that is where government has also created, you know, the business opportunity, the enabling environment, the business-friendly environment for investors, both Ghanaian nationals and, you know, expatriates to come in and comfortably invest in the agriculture sector. When you invest, it will not only be for even local consumption. You know, we have a company like Blue Skies. It's doing very, very well. Blue Skies has come to invest in pineapple, you know, fruit juice. And they export. And, you know, the demand for their produce on the local market is also very, very high. And so government, yes, has policies that has been formulated. But, and again, sometimes I think that it's a culture that we had, but it's changing. People are now changing and beginning to appreciate what we have. People tend to think, you know, we want what is from outside because they think is better than what is from inside. You could actually even harvest Ghanaian rice and bag it in a foreign bag. And people will patronize that, thinking it's been, and they will tell you how good it is. But now Ghanaians have started patronizing, you know, Ghanaian rice, Ghana poultry, and Ghana tomatoes. And so we are inviting, you know, people to come in, Ghanaians, even you can come, you know, and come and invest in the agriculture sector. They are right, we shouldn't be, you know, importing from anywhere. We should rather be, you know, eating what we produce and rather also try and have access to the international market.
Hold your thought. We'll come to you in the second part of the show. Dr. Hannah Bisu is Ghana's Deputy Agricultural Minister. She joined us live here in Washington, D.C. Rioting left one person dead in Guinea's capital, Conakry, on Friday ahead of the presidential election that the opposition wants to postpone. For VOA, Chris Stein has this report.
Guinea has been tense for weeks as opposition parties have pushed to postpone presidential elections planned for this Sunday while accusing the polling authorities of bias. On Friday, tensions in some neighborhoods in the capital erupted. Looters ransacked a local market while clashes between rival political supporters left one person dead and 20 injured, according to local media. Two people were killed in similar fighting on Thursday. A VOA journalist near Conakry's Medina Market witnessed looters bashing the padlocks off closed shops and absconding with the goods. Police joined in the pilfering, making off with bags of merchandise that appeared to come from the shops. The looting comes just before Sunday's presidential vote, only the second since Guinea returned to democracy in 2010. A number of candidates are challenging Alpha Conde, with former Prime Minister Seydou Alassane Diallo seen as the main threat to the incumbent. Witnesses said the looting at the market was a direct consequence of the political tensions. Barry Mukhtar, a supporter of Diallo, said he and his fellow shopkeepers were defending their shops from supporters of Conde.
Dès le matin, ils ont repris ils ont vengé contre nous.
He says in the morning, looters came and attacked their shops. They're in the streets to defend against the looters. Underneath a nearby bridge, Abdoulaye Dabo was among the merchants trying to put out a fire in a building they said was set alight by opposition supporters. He accused Diallo supporters of trying to agitate people to start trouble across the country. Guinea has a history of violence around elections. In 2013, over 50 people were killed in the run-up to legislative polls. In the city's quiet downtown, lawyer Babacar Sampil said he hoped for a peaceful vote. Violence doesn't help the country, he says. He condemned what happened on Friday. Despite calls from Diallo and others for a postponement, election authorities say they are ready for people to vote. Chris Stein for VOA News, Conakry, Guinea.
Next, on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali and his guests celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Million Man March. We'll examine its significance to the Black American community and to the African diaspora 20 years later. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa. Next on Let's Talk, arranged marriage. The type of marital union where the bride and the groom are selected by a third party. Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing arranged marriage. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today while we get ready to interact with Ghana's Agricultural Deputy Minister, Dr. Hannah Bisio.
Personally, I go deal with you. Personally, I go deal with you. I go deal with you personally, professionally. I see what you're doing intentionally. Get me wanted physically, so give it to me radically. Emotionally, psychologically, you're turning me on biologically, sexually, dramatically. And she talks that she know what I mean. I no go lie, the things within my mind. When I see you dancing, girl, you got me high. And if you wanna try, make a good day tonight. Cause I'm in the mood. As long as you're feeling the good, I go deal with you personally. Personally, I go deal with you personally, I go deal with you.
Spiritually, money speaking so drastically, magically, internationally, Abba, abatically, Rama, now for dictionary, Saga, for she know what me, she talks that she know what me.
I know what I, the things within my mind, when I see you dancing. Start giving you all you need. Oh yeah, Sade Waka, Sisi Sade Waka, Sade Waka, Openi Waka, Sade Waka, Owole Waka. Baby, go down, money go low. Sade Waka, Sisi Sade Waka, Sade Waka, Openi Waka, Sade Waka, Owole Waka. Baby, go down, money go low. Sade Waka, Sisi Sade Waka, Sade Waka, Openi Waka, Sade Waka, Owole Waka.
Mr. DJ, what are you saying? Put us on a replay. After this one, put it back on replay. If you're feeling this one, let me hear you say. Stash on the beat, double bass, killing this. We don't count with the queen, we don't count for the street. Count with the twist, let it dance with your hips. Sense on the scene, I'll tell him what you think.
Hey,
I'll
all man day na the dance floor. DJ, why you dey relax for? Play that song and they ask for. Ask for, ask for. All man day na the dance floor. DJ, why you dey relax for? This not the song and they ask for. Ask for. I say, no girl to girl, all man to man. We don't hold on hand to hand. Fine body girl, let me BBM. Fine for me girl, make a BBM. Sexy girl, see me with them. Like Titanic, when I sing with them.
Still listening to Nightline Africa on the Voice of America, and we are still with Dr. Hannah Bisu, Ghana's Deputy Agricultural Minister. Well, Dr. Bisu, the investment summit is ongoing today in Washington, D.C. Let's look at the challenges and opportunities in Ghana's housing sector. You know much about this. What will you be telling these investors?
Well, challenges in Ghana housing sector is that we are in deficit of over 1 million homes. And these are the challenges. The opportunities is that the real estate, you know, business, it's doing very well in the country. A lot of people now want to own homes. We don't want to rent homes. We want to own homes. There are some companies that are already also doing mortgage for, you know, government workers. And we are welcoming any good technology, you know, apart from the traditional one that we know, that to also make a housing affordable to meet the needs of the middle class, working class. And so the Works and Housing, for instance, which is in charge of housing, that's the Ministry of Water Resources, Works and Housing.
Right.
They have land banks. When I talk about the land bank, the ministry acquires, you know, huge parcels of land. So when investors come in and they want to go into the housing, you know, business, you meet with the ministry and then they will allocate a parcel of that land bank. It means that you're going to have a land, a house of free land, land where you're not having any litigations. Or,
well, I'm not cutting you short, but the controversy has always been land grabs, litigation, one person owning a land and three or four people challenging them. There's a long court process. How do you cut across all that clutter?
That is the land bank of the Ministry of Water Resources, Works and Housing. That's a government policy. And so the ministry has acquired, you know, land banks for this purpose. Now, tax holidays in the housing or the real estate, you know, it's when you go into business with government. We talk about business with government when you go with the Ministry of Food and Agriculture. You have a memorandum of understanding, and then, you know, your structure or the plan, the design, you know, is screened by the architectural, you know, department of the ministry. Then it's approved. Then the ministry will allocate according to the number of houses that you want to build. They will locate across the country for you. Maybe in Accra, you go to Kumasi, the regional capitals sometimes, or any other place that you want to go as an investor. Then you also enjoy the 5 years tax holiday on that. Mm. Earlier on, it was for everything, but we realized that a lot of people were enjoying the tax holidays, and the housing they were putting up were extremely expensive. You know, maybe a two-bedroom was over $200,000. And so the class that government wants to meet their needs, we were not, you know, achieving that. And so we had to leave some special incentive for people who want to go into affordable housing to meet the needs of the middle, the low to middle income people.
I see a policy here where it's investor-driven. What about the ordinary Ghanaian? How do you cut the clutter for the ordinary Ghanaian to be able to afford to purchase or lease a land, put up a structure, an affordable house, and such that they will be comfortable to work for the government or the private industry, whatever they want to do in their own land?
Well, when for you to acquire land, okay, Ghana land is not owned by government.
Right.
Okay, Ghana land is owned by traditional leaders.
Right.
And so you're supposed to go to the traditional leader or to the stool that owns the land and, you know, properly acquire the land. If you should go to just any other person, then you fall in the, you know, in the situation where a land is sold to you that does not belong to the one who sold the land, or it belongs to two or three people, especially family lands. When you go to a place and this is a family land, you know, you have to then meet the family, the head of the family, together with the family. Then a decision is made. And so for those, we have them. But we also have, you know, the State Housing Corporation that also acquires land and also, you know, builds for people at an affordable, you know, price. Also, we have the Tema, you know, Development Corporation that mm-hmm. also acquires land and sometimes services the land and sells it out, which is also litigation free. And they can also build for you at, you know, an affordable price. So for the Ghanaian, the ordinary Ghanaian, when you live in the country, you know exactly where or how to get the land. The policy that is investor-driven is to make sure that the investor is comfortable when they want to come into the country to invest their money in the real estate, you know. Or if even it's a local investor, if it's a Ghanaian who wants to go into, you know, large or huge production of, you know, real estate houses for, you know, to meet the needs of, you know, the working class, then government will have to take steps to make sure that the investment is secure. The investor also has some sort of peace with the land that they are going to use for their development.
Now, let me ask you this. The critics of the government have said that it appears that Ghanaians who are into investment or are having opportunities have something to do with the ruling party, the National Democratic Congress, and it's only them that are benefiting in this tax holidays and this incentives. Well, what is your answer to that?
I'm laughing because it's definitely not possible. When you talk about tax holiday, it's an act that has been passed in Parliament. And so when there's a law, everybody enjoys the law. You don't have to belong to any party. Okay, when somebody's coming in, you know, to bring an investment, you don't even know which party the person belongs to. If he's a foreigner, you don't even know who is his or her Ghanaian partner. Let me give an example. last 4 years I was in the Ministry of Water Resources, Works and Housing, you know, as a deputy minister. And one of the huge projects that government gave it all to support the investor, but unfortunately, because of, you know, boardroom wrangling, they couldn't, you know, carry on, you know, with the project, was the STX. And BK Asamoah is a staunch NPP.
The opposition.
The opposition.
Right.
And BK enjoyed all the support right from the late president and our current president, who was the vice president, and the ministers of the ministry, which includes me, that we did a lot to make sure that this project could come on. But it seems that between the, you know, BK and his Korean counterparts, there was some sort of misunderstanding. So eventually they couldn't, you know, carry on with the project. This is just to tell you that, you know, for the laws that are there, you just go and you enjoy every law that benefits business. Once you're a Ghanaian, or if even you're a foreigner and investor, we have laws in the country that, you know, you can also benefit from. So it's not true that you have to belong to the ruling party.
Now, briefly, before we go back to the music, you are a member of parliament as well. Several people have made suggestions that the government, or for that matter, the executive, tend to get whatever he or she wants, and that parliament has not been effective in acting as a check and balance as enshrined in the constitution. Briefly, what is your answer to that?
I don't think so. I think the parliament is very strict. The executive doesn't get what they want. Parliament, a lot of the times, we work, you know, from the select committees. That is where we really do the parliamentary work. Anything that comes on the floor of parliament is for it to be debated. But the real work, the checks, you know, the scrutiny, everything has already been done. And sometimes when it even comes and another member or another group thinks that it has to go by, it goes back. So it's not like that. But we can't hold government. We just have to support and make sure that the right thing is done. So when the executive brings something and it's not right, we have to urge the executive to do the right thing so it's corrected, and then we pass it. We are not there to halt the work of government. We are there to make sure that the laws are used, the laws are made, and then the executive uses the right laws and the right things to work.
Thank you very much. That was Ghana's Deputy Agricultural Minister, Dr. Hannah Bisu. We'll return to the music. It makes me sing, ooh, la, la, la. The way she, the way she that. It makes me sing, ooh, la, la, la. Oh, yeah. When mommy come back, she a jump. Daddy come to me a cross. And when they ask me, it wasn't me. That's what me talk say. I know like this, just touching body. Yeah, yeah. Now, Jets. I want for more. That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. Simultaneously, I pay attention to the African media and see what are the opinions of Africans towards this foreign policy. And this week, we have a number of issues going on in the world. The question of the Middle East, which is a big issue for the United States. And President Obama, the Secretary of State, and the Congress are all involved in what is going on in Syria. This has implications for Africa, because because American policy towards Africa has been very much affected by U.S. policy towards Russia or the former Soviet Union. What is the role of the leader of Russia, President Putin, and his activities in Syria? And how does this affect U.S. policy in the Middle East, U.S. policy towards Israel, U.S. policy towards Iran, and the whole peace deal? Here, we go back to deja vu, back to the Cold War, but in a different guise. What is very serious now for the policymakers in these United States and the policymakers in Russia is to see how can we solve the peace between the United States and Iran. Because this peace deal is very critical for the United States, and the president is pushing very hard to push for it. There are some opponents to the peace between the United States, but hopefully it will enjoy the moral support of people who really want to have peace, just like President Kennedy was able to wiggle out of the problem when he had a crisis in Cuba and we survived as a race from that crisis. We as a race are now in a very critical moment in time, because you have the former Soviet Union is gone. Even the Chinese, who are beneficiaries of the Cold War because of Russian support, have now evolved to a point where they realize we have to move on towards peace. The days of Mao Zedong are gone. Now we want to have peace between the United States and the other nations of the world on a very trying time. What makes the problem is fear. Fear. Fear, stupid. This fear originating from Israel with regard to the peace deal is creating problems not only for the Israeli people, but also for those Americans who are very supportive of Israel and are very apprehensive about the Iranians. Again, here, fear, fear, fear among the Americans is legitimate because of what happened during the Khomeini period and the taking of the American hostages and all the narrative that took place. Even though Reagan tried to make peace with Iran, and of course, Iran-Contra is one problem for all of us who are analysts looking at world politics. We can't forget those days. But the Republicans are being told, please, 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 remember that world peace is more important than political peddling of ideas. This is my opinion to our leaders. What has to be done is to make sure that we put the Iranian feet to the fire. They are very lucky because of historical development. That's why I always tell my students that God may be writing a video, because it just happened by chance. The president doesn't have to be called Barack Hussein Obama. He was born with that name, and he has a name, Hussein. He has nothing to do with that as a boy when he was coming up. But history, in his own way of ironies and paradoxes, put him there. What the Iranians have to do, they have to make sure that they don't betray the Americans. And the Israelis have to give the Americans the benefit of the doubt, because the Americans are not going to betray the Israelis. The Americans fought against Hitler. We are not going to betray them. What we have to make categorically clear to the Israeli leadership, to the Iranians, to the Russians, and the Western allies, particularly the English and the French, who fought with America in World War II against the Nazis and worked with the Soviet Union during President Roosevelt. This is history. It's not movies from Hollywood. It's history of human beings. Today, when we look at this issue, we're talking about the life of all of us as human beings. We have to have peace, and we must deal with fear, fear, fear. We have to protect ourselves as a race before we have any confrontation that is fatal for all of us. And that's the Nyangian message to all of these people today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the English service of the Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, our engineer for today, John Dryden, and we say a big thanks to Dr. Hannah Bisu, Ghana's Deputy Agricultural Minister, for joining us today. And remember, as the elders say, quality beat, do not rattle. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes Mozambique's recent announcement that it has completed clearance of all known fields of landmines in the country. Since 1993, when Mozambique emerged from decades of conflict as one of the world's most landmine-affected nations, the United States has been proud to partner with the people of Mozambique, investing more than $55 million toward improving the safety and security of local communities through the U.S. Conventional Weapons Destruction Program. Through that partnership, which includes the international donor community and humanitarian demining organizations, we have worked diligently to safely clear landmines and unexploded ordnance, prevent injuries through community outreach and education, and provide medical and social services to survivors of accidents involving these legacies of past conflicts. The United States is proud to be the world's leading provider of financial and technical assistance to help countries address this serious humanitarian challenge. Since 1993, we have invested approximately $2.5 billion in aid in more than 90 countries to decrease the threat posed by landmines and explosive remnants of war. Our efforts have dramatically reduced the world's annual landmine casualty rate and helped 16 countries declare themselves landmine-free. Humanitarian demining in places like Mozambique sets the stage for post-conflict recovery and development. It is another important way in which the United States promotes international peace and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.